Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today we're excited to welcome Dr. Carmen Bolter of the University of Calgary in Canada. Now, Dr. Bolter is an expert on our ancient past. Her five-part documentary series called The Pyramid Code is a groundbreaking investigation of an advanced early culture and the lost history of ancient Egypt. Now, Dr. Bolter is releasing a new documentary series later this year called The New Atlantis. This ambitious series will go even further in establishing the fact that a highly advanced culture was a major influence on early civilization. But what were their origins? And how does this all relate to the enigmatic pharaoh Akhenaten and Queen Nefertiti? Have we been given the whole story? Here we go. Dr. Carmen Bolter, The Breakthrough Atlantean-Egyptian Connection.
But we've departed so far in this culture from, you know, the idea of archetypal beings, star beings, channeling, having a communication with ancestors that are disincarnate. You know, we went through the Inquisition. That was a no-no. If you thought that, they'd kill you. There is another story than the official story that we've been given in mainstream media. And, you know, I think there's more and more people that know that mainstream media isn't necessarily true. And I think the tragedy of our current culture is that truth is an option.
You know, for centuries, the academic and archaeological worlds have taken all the evidence for an advanced culture in our ancient past and simply refused to accept it. It's almost as if some deeper secret is being protected, and anything that goes beyond the traditional model of culture starting in a small part of the Middle East 6,000 years ago is an act of professional heresy with major penalties. Yet we do have in our midst the qualified researchers who followed the evidence and come to very different conclusions of chronology, culture, and technological advancement in ancient Egypt. So let's go talk with Dr. Carmen Bolter.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist. Let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, everyone, I'm excited about today's show, and I want to mention before we get started that today's guest will be presenting at the Global Pyramid Conference in Chicago on the weekend of May 13th. You can visit globalpyramidconference.com for more details on that. It sounds fascinating, and we'll ask Carmen all about it. Carmen, it's excellent to have you here on the show. I've been following your work with some great interest now for a while.
Nice to meet you, Daniel.
Now, I'm most familiar with your work on the Pyramid Code, which is an amazing and inspiring five-part documentary series that you created. It gets into all sorts of really fascinating information on the hidden side of ancient Egypt. I think of it as a kind of mystical scientific walk through ancient history, and you employ some bold techniques like intuitive insight in your research, which really makes it a powerful series. Now, how did you come to make The Pyramid Code?
Well, actually, I was working as a professor at a university in Taiwan, and I did three international academic cooperation projects for the Ministry of Education. And I was making video tutorials because I was teaching online interactive multimedia curriculum. And they bought me HD cameras and tripods and computers, and they flew me around to do various things. And then I realized, well, if I have this equipment and I'm continuing on my vacations to go back to Egypt, maybe I can film Hakim, because Hakim's the indigenous wisdom keeper, and he was getting frail and arthritic, and I knew that he didn't have much time left. And I thought, well, no one's really captured his legacy. So I took the equipment and I went to Egypt and I filmed him.
That's great.
But then, in order to understand Hakim, I needed to find scientists that would corroborate what he was saying, because he's an indigenous wisdom keeper. So he's not trying to prove anything. He just knows. Mm-hmm. And then to have animations to explain some of the constructs, and then voiceover, you know, to link it all together. And so it really came from wanting to capture Hakim before he passed.
That is so interesting. And he's definitely a highlight to the documentary. I know that he shares so much of what he learned there in Egypt. And I wasn't even familiar with him at all, to be honest with you, before I saw the documentary. So you did everyone a great service there by introducing us to him before he passed away. He had a unique knowledge of ancient Egypt. And more than that, I think he really grasped the mystery of the Giza Plateau.
Well, he was born at the foot of the Abusir pyramids and then migrated over to a house at the foot of the Sphinx. But his elders really passed the knowledge down, and it was the ancient Suf language, like Sufi dancing. And so Arabic is modern Egyptian language, but this was an older language. And so it really was about giving the knowledge verbally down through the generation. He also trained as an archaeologist in Europe.
Okay, now that's intriguing. So he basically had both skill sets going on at the same time, the deep wisdom with the academic background. Fascinating. Now, what was it, Carmen, that drew you to Egypt in the first place?
I was interested in it starting as a little girl, looking up, you know, the continent of Africa and wanting to go there. And I went there for the first time in 1977, and that totally turned me around when I saw real artifacts and was exposed to the pyramids and the energy and the Sphinx. It really just turned me into a different person.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I've gone back many, many times since then.
Right, right. And you've led tours there also.
I was doing that until not long ago. I did 20 years of tours, but now it's harder to get in because the visa process has changed. People's financial situations are a little bit more unstable, so yes can sometimes turn into no. And a lot of people have bought into that it's dangerous. So there's never been a trip to Egypt from 1977 to a year ago this week where I found it dangerous at all. But you don't know that if you haven't been. And so if they keep on telling you it's dangerous, then people, you know, start to believe it.
Oh, no question. There's incredible propaganda out there about this. Now, one thing I wanted to point out is that the version of Egypt that you've discovered in your research, what I'd almost call a kind of mystical Egypt, what do you think the official version and the archaeological record of ancient Egypt is missing? Because it seems like new discovery after new discovery, the standard academic view that Egyptologists hold is being proved wrong again and again. What is the fundamental flaw in the standard model?
I would say the dating system. So they said that it was 2450 BC that the Great Pyramid was built. And there's nothing... Nothing relates to that that I've found. Everything seems to be much older, but everything in school and the Bible, you know, want us to think that we're 6,000 years old. And I don't think that's feasible. But the construction of the pyramids and then the temples along the Nile seem like two different time frames. And so I think we need to look a whole lot further back. And that's what the Pyramid Code was doing, showing the precession of the equinoxes, linear time, and giving us a map to go back, because most of us don't know how to think of things that old.
Right, absolutely. And when you've been there, staring at the Great Pyramid, do you get a sense of something that comes from a totally different culture based on higher spiritual principles and a feeling of the transcendent that just infuses the pyramids and the plateau there? And we know, of course, that in the traditional model, you know, the Great Pyramid is just built as a tomb for the pharaoh Khufu. What do you think it is really?
Well, the fact that they never found a single mummy in any straight-sided pyramid ever doesn't seem to dissuade them from calling them tombs.
Right.
The energy in the pyramid is palpable. I spent a lot of time in it by myself over and over and inside the body of the Sphinx. And there's a lot to the energy, and it can be explained. And explaining pyramid energy is part of my new series. For me, I ended up becoming far more psychic than I was, and I started to think that it had to do with exposure to the energy. So I actually ran a longitudinal study collecting data with a special instrument from Russia that I was trained on to measure consciousness fields. Is literally what Dr. Konstantin Korkov had invented, this GDV-EPI, it's electrophotonic imaging, and actually demonstrating with hundreds of people doing four readings that the pyramid, from a statistically significant perspective, could affect the human aura and chakras.
Wow, that is really intriguing. And the fact that we find pyramids all over the world gives us some idea that there's an older, forgotten culture back there that understood what these pyramids were for. And the practice of its construction became widely disseminated sometime way back.
Well, the trick with this, and I think that Dr. Samos Manigic and the Bosnian pyramid really opened the door to this, is that there's a number of pyramids that are being found that had a layer of silt that was sufficient to grow trees. So when you look across the countryside, it doesn't look like the pyramids are straight-sided or that they're even pyramids. They could be pyramid-shaped hills, what is what most people thought. And I always wonder if you could take a helicopter and trim all the trees straight, you would see that it actually is a straight-sided pyramid. And so they've excavated a whole row all the way up. And they actually found some organic material between the third and the fourth course. And it was dated to 38,000 years ago, which means it was before the flood.
Uh-huh.
And so if the whole world flooded, or most of the world, and silt was deposited because of the flood, when the water receded, the silt would have stayed on the pyramids and then trees would have grown.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's only coming to light now. So there's two in South Africa, there's one in Serbia. So these tree-covered pyramids are showing up. There's one in Indonesia, Gunung Padang, where I've just been. And so this is a worldwide phenomena that is just coming to light.
Just incredible. Now, there have been so many different guesses by Egyptologists for the date of the construction of the Great Pyramid, and they settled at right about 2500 BC. But there have been a number of studies, some of them in your documentary series, for example. Geologist Robert Schock did extensive tests of the weathering pattern of the Sphinx and found that it should be dated closer to 10,000 years old. There's also other evidence in archaeoastronomy where they can tell something's age by the constellation it was built to symbolize. And that suggests it was built in 10,000 BC for the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid. So now we're talking 12,000 years ago. How do you feel the chronology holds up, and how does it look to you?
Well, this is still in question, and you know, research is inching everything back further and further. 2450 BC, what I make of that is it would have been the last renovation they did. Mm-hmm. So you would never think, if you painted your house last year, that that would be an indication of when the house was built.
Right.
Right. But something happened last year, and the paint is fresh. So I think that there is an insistence that things aren't as old as you know, people don't want, they don't want to go there. but in my research now about Atlantis through the ancient texts and whatnot, it seems that there were three disasters in Atlantis, and that Atlantis had enough time to go golden and iron age and round a few times. And so I think we want to pinpoint one time where they say Atlantis was corrupt and they were doing experiments with animals and humans, and They were so corrupt that a flood came.
Yes.
Right? And I think we get stuck in the last flood. So my information from these ancient texts and from evidence that I've been gathering is that 58,000 years ago, there was a flood or a disaster. And 17,500, there was tremendous solar flare activity that was enough to create a catastrophe. And then 13,660 some, the Earth was hit with by an asteroid. And so there's a lot of talk about that last one. But if we can look back further, it seems that on telluric currents, there's pyramids. And if you go straight through the center of the Earth, you come out at a volcano. And so there was something about the telluric grid, which is the ley lines or dragon lines, where if there was a heavy structure that connected to something that was molten that went through the center of the Earth, that it may have assisted to hold the magnetic fields in place. And it was a magnetic reversal that caused the second disaster. So this is, it's still speculative, but I think I'm piecing together something that makes sense.
Well, you have a new documentary coming up now, which is a follow-up to the Pyramid Code, but it's going into even more uncharted territory, and you're calling it The New Atlantis?
It's called The New Atlantis. In essence, it's looking at what I just said, that period of time and who the Atlanteans could have been, but then we're bringing it into new futures. So how could the value system of the Atlanteans be carried forward? Who's doing things now that if it isn't good for everyone, it's not good at all? Things that are sustainable, a new economy, new paradigm in education, communication, transportation, everything. And so we're showcasing in the final episode how wonderful things that people are doing exist, because the mainstream media doesn't want to give us good news.
Right.
It doesn't seem to. But where does that link to? And what were the value systems of the ancient Egyptians? So there's new information based on what Plato said. And so if you look at the two main ancient texts that he talked about line by line, he talked about 32 different points. Elephants and, you know, two seasons and unified. Well, he didn't talk about unified writing. That's another point. But anyway, then Danny Irwato in Indonesia made a chart of all the places that people have claimed Atlantis could have been. You know, Santorini, Crete, Troy, and it goes on and on, right? Antarctica.
Bermuda.
Yes, the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, that's a major place.
So that would be the Bimini Road.
South America.
Pardon me?
South America.
Peru, the high altiplano.
Right.
So I think we have the propensity because of school to go A, B, C, D. But what about it being a worldwide seafaring culture? It could easily have been colonized.
Mm-hmm.
But still, that being said, where would the capital have been? And is there somewhere on the planet that has all the points that Plato talked about? And the answer is yes.
Well, okay. This is pretty exciting. Where is it that all of the features in Plato's story of Atlantis can be found?
Java.
Well, that is intriguing.
So I spoke at a university in Badang, Indonesia, Java, with Danny Irwato and Dr. Danny Hillman, who is the responsible geologist for the pyramid at Ganang Padang. And we were all presenting evidence, physical evidence of Atlantis possibly having been in the main place. So how do we piece together what happened? Why did they become seafaring? Did they colonize? How'd they colonize? But the other part, and this is mind-blowing, there's a couple of temples. There's a temple that if I showed you the picture and asked you where you thought it was, you'd say, oh, that's Mayan. That's Mexico. There's a Mayan temple in Indonesia.
Huh.
Which is, anyway, there's another place called Penataran.
Where is that one?
Pardon me?
Where is the Mayan temple?
In Indonesia.
And can you say at this point where in Indonesia?
West Java.
Okay.
The other side, East Java, is where there's a temple, and they have a legend that there was a beautiful princess and people came from all over the world to marry her. Except there's Egyptian women. I'm not sure the Egyptian women came to marry her. But what's represented there is the Mayans with the flat bridge nose and the feathers in their hair, Chinese, East Indian, Sumerian, and ancient Egyptian, all represented in one temple. So it's like, whoa, what do you make of that? So I'm looking to explain and hypothesize that that could be something, and it links to a lot of other things, that it could be that all these groups actually existed in the main city, and then they decided to colonize. After the first disaster, there were committees, evacuation committees, is my understanding, of what are we going to do to protect the stuff? How are we going to protect the people, the technology? And there were decisions to colonize and go build straight-sided pyramids on these telluric dragon lines around the world. So just think, I mean, if we were doing that now and we knew that the disaster was coming and we were going to send groups around, it stands to reason that there's different groups now that have their own style of dressing, style of music, style of dancing, whatever. So, you know, a group of hip-hop guys would go there, the ballerinas go here, the firemen go there, and that these groups could already have existed. Now, the point is, it's a third-party hypothesis. So if all of the civilizations that I mentioned had pyramid building, knowledge of astronomy, astrology, connection to star systems, and a cultural civilization, but they didn't necessarily talk to each other. Perhaps they all had similar ancestors.
Yeah.
So that starts to be not so far-fetched.
Right, absolutely. And you mentioned a few cultures there that were crucial to the development of civilization, like Sumeria, like Egypt. Would you view the high achievement of these cultures as a legacy from a more advanced Atlantis?
I'm starting to think that's a strong possibility. Now, we can't say it's proven, but, you know, in PhD studies, you hedge. You don't, you say the data seems to indicate.
Mm-hmm.
There's correlations that have been made. And we can't go out and say, we know. But that's what a lot of documentaries do. It is, we know,
right.
Here's the date. It wasn't 9,000 years, it was 9,000 moons. And, you know, and they make statements like Plato was heartbroken because Socrates was sentenced to death and he drank poison. And so he needed to feel better. So he made up a story about Atlantis.
Right.
Well, maybe, but I doubt it. You know what I'm saying? So but when people come out with really strong conviction that this is what happened, and that we learned that from school, you know, the legal profession has to find somebody to blame, and then they close the book. The case is closed. School, TV, you know, lots of things. Hollywood tell us it is.
Yes.
The news, it is. And I'm not sure that we can make those sorts of convictions. So, and the reason that that's true for PhD research and dissertations is in 20 years, because you're published, you necessarily are published if you, you know, produce and pass the candidacy and the defense, that in 20 years, if something new is found, you said, from what we know now, from the data, it seems to support the hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this work, it, you know, where do you get a hypothesis? You can get a hypothesis in a dream, in my case, past life memory. And then you got to go in the field. So the policy that I have with my documentaries is the audience should never ask, how do you know? Or what do you mean? But a lot of times when I'm listening to people and they're going, it is, how do you know? Help me trace back where you got your data.
Uh-huh.
What do you mean? Define the terms. Right? And how does grief cause a fantasy? You know?
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't add up. And so I think we need to go step by step. And I say triangulate information. So if I hear a story that makes sense, but I can't, you know, verify it, I won't use it.
Right.
Right. So that's the method that I use with these documentaries, and also asking questions. Like the first questions in the Pyramid Code were, who were the ancients and what did they know? And the last question at the end of the fifth episode is, how would our society change if consciousness was the highest value instead of profit?
Interesting question.
Right. So posing a question instead of, I know it is, because I think it's easier to listen to. And I think that's why people really appreciated the Pyramid Code, because they had room to guess for themselves, see how it fit, right? Instead of this dogmatic approach.
Oh, yeah. And I think it really is a landmark documentary. It brings together incredible production values with great insight and insightful interviews. So it's really quite an achievement. And that's why I'm so excited for your new one. And speaking of this new Atlantis documentary, now when do you expect that one to come out?
Well, I'm aiming for July, which may be a bit too ambitious, but I've got the score composed and we've got footage from 10 countries and I've got an animation team and we're editing currently. We've got a new trailer and we're negotiating for where it will be aired. So we're in good shape. It's daunting, though, to put it together. It's a huge task. And so I don't know if we'll be finished by July, but I'm aiming to be.
Okay, but this year for sure.
Oh, yeah, this year.
Great. This is excellent news. Now, since you mentioned past lives in there, I really want to go a little bit deeper on that. We have information about the Hall of Records put into the heart of ancient Egypt by the fleeing Atlanteans who were escaping destruction at the time. And the original modern source for this concept is the famous mystic and psychic Edgar Cayce. And actually, he was in a psychic trance discussing past lives in ancient Egypt when this came up. And he tapped into this information about an Atlantean Hall of Records beneath the right paw of the Sphinx. Now, there are obscure references to something like a Hall of Records in antiquity through the Middle Ages. And also, Cayce suggested that the Atlanteans' high council of what he called the Law of One put these special records of Atlantis, their technology, and advanced spiritual wisdom in three different places, one of them being there in Egypt. So what did you find out about Cayce's Hall of Records in your research, and how did that relate to your own past life mystery in Egypt?
Well, first of all, I had a place, a six-bedroom flat, right on the Giza Plateau, right on the edge of the Giza Plateau, and I called it the Hall of Records Retreat Center.
Oh, wow. Okay?
So I definitely was interested in the subject. I learned about an ancient text from the Star Visions Conference from a woman named Chelsea Floor, who's since passed, bless her soul. And they were talking about chambers underneath the Great Pyramid and in the tunnel system below. And so I spent basically 5 years after the plateau closed, in and out of the holes and looking around and seeing if I could ascertain if there was something there. And then I started looking at, you know, my PhD's in linguistics and, you know, under the paw of the Sphinx. So you've seen probably the documentary where Robert Schalk and John Anthony West are there and Zahi's there and they drill a hole, a small hole beside the paw, and then they've got a metal plate and a thing wired to it that has a dial like that, and then they're using a sledgehammer to ascertain if it's hollow underneath. And that's kind of a primitive test.
Right.
And that was a number of years ago that they're doing that, and they concluded, yeah, there's something down there, or maybe some people concluded, no, there's nothing down there. But I started to look at the what if the word was beneath? So it was maybe a little bit in front of, you know, like, because that's what happens with translations is if you get the preposition wrong. Chinese people sit in a chair, we sit on a chair. Mm-hmm. But the preposition, you know, very slight changes in translations can change the meaning of something altogether. And so, you know, I've been looking for this place for 25 years. And so part of the New Atlantis is showing a desert expedition where we went and you know, there was speculation that they could have had ties to Atlantis and there was a place and it was really deep and it was in the middle of the desert, which would indicate that it's, you know, obscure and possibly old. And we went to this place with a Russian scientist and this equipment and had to fly in with a hot air balloon. And it was a military area, so we had to get special permits. And we go in there with our jeeps and desert camping and the whole thing. And it actually was a target for the Air Force. And there were exploded bombs all around. And the place was falling apart. It was probably about 30 years old.
Wow.
And it was like not it at all. But on the way to, you know, setting up the expedition, I consult with a woman who's a very, very high level psychic. And, you know, we were both feeling this tremendous depth and really old and more than one level of this.
Well, you knew you were closing in on something. So then what happened?
So then another round of, again, if in the ancient text, all I have to say is this is two-thirds of the way up the west face of the Great Pyramid, when the whole story is at another location altogether, that in order to protect the story, all you have to do is say it's over there when it's really over there.
I see.
And there's lots of that going on, right? So, you know, this has been a bit of a psychological minefield to get through.
Absolutely. And I can imagine the temptation to just throw up your hands and say, let's get out of here.
And however, as I said, I've been looking for this place for 25 years. And so last year, we went back to Egypt. Klaus Dohna has access to high-definition, super-powerful, high-resolution satellite scans that are run by logarithms that take the live feed on the satellite scan and are able to look 6 kilometers deep into the Earth.
And this is fascinating. That's called space archaeology. And when we come back, we're going to get very deep into what that all means and unlock some secrets around Queen Nefertiti and the pharaoh Akhenaten. We're coming back with Dr. Carmen Bolter. Stay with us.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
Sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, a saucer came flying over their heads, put down 3 little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
The academic and archaeological worlds have taken all the evidence for an advanced culture in our ancient past and simply refused to accept it.
Hidden technology.
So in other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption because it is literally... It is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors along with everything else into every human body.
For more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm here with Carmen Bolter of the University of Calgary. Carmen produced and directed the groundbreaking 5-part documentary series called The Pyramid Code. Her new documentary series promises to send out even more shockwaves. It's called The New Atlantis, and it's going to feature some powerful new revelations on the message of an ancient advanced culture lost to history. Can't wait for this one. In the meantime, you can see Carmen at the Global Pyramid Conference in Chicago the weekend of May 13th. And I guess before we jump back in here, Carmen, why don't you give us an idea about the conference and what you'll be presenting on?
I'll be presenting on my new research on the New Atlantis and some recent finds that are quite relevant to what we're doing. But I'm particularly excited. It's called the Global Pyramid Conference that Dr. Sam Osmanagic from Bosnian Pyramids and Valerie Uvarov, who actually spearheaded this project, and a number of other people will be talking on pyramid energy. And so we'll be in really good company, but it's an action-packed program. So there'll be activities on the Friday night and Saturday night, really long days, but, you know, worthwhile for people to come and get a lot of information.
Yes, it sounds exciting. Now, who put all this together? Because it's such a unique idea.
Yeah, Marta Thomas has put it together.
Excellent. And it's all kinds of different pyramids, not only Egyptian and Mayan, but also Bosnian and so many others.
Oh, and it's pyramid energy. Like there's Valerie Uvarov has actually constructed a functional energetic pyramid in Russia.
Interesting.
And he's been studying pyramid energy for a long time. And so how it works and what makes it work. And there's some remarkable things that have happened in that pyramid already because of the energy, the new one.
Wow. Well, it sounds like a breakthrough. And it's coming up in just a few weeks. So for more information, it's all at globalpyramidconference.com.
Yeah, I think it'll be really a choice conference.
It's going to be exciting for sure. And I think there's so much for us to discover about the pyramids. So we'll stay tuned there. And picking up on this new technology that we were discussing, now this might really blow away some of the misconceptions around ancient culture by helping us find the most important sites. What is it exactly? It's called space archaeology.
It's space archaeology. And the value of this particular technique that they're using, or technology, is that if you hit a layer, you can look through the layer to the next thing and to the next thing. And so with most ground-penetrating radar, particularly the kind that lays wires on the ground, and then, you know, has there it goes 12 meters deep, which isn't the same thing, right? And so I found this place on GPS by looking at ancient maps and looking at Google Earth, and I got the GPS coordinates, and Klaus asked me for them. And he came back a few days later and went, ooh, we really found something here. Now, the verifiability, again, everything, I used to teach quantitative research methods at the graduate level at the University of Calgary. So there's a method for doing this sort of research. But what you're looking to do when you take tests is you want to look at the reliability and the validity of the test. So the reliability is if somebody else came and used the same test in this place or close, they would get the same results.
Right.
Right. And the validity is, are you measuring what you think you're measuring? And so when this technique first came out, there were governments from around the world that were hiring this company because they wanted to find oil and gas. And then they decided they didn't want to support that because of obvious reasons. They would rather do things that were beneficial to humanity. But,
yes,
you know, they found, they scanned and found underwater rivers in California, underground rivers, deep in the earth. They were finding water in Zimbabwe at a, you know, very deep, 170 meters or something. They found gold in Bolivia. So there's a different logarithm for gold, pottery, bone, water, oil, gas, precious metals, precious jewels. And so they run the test with the logarithm that's the signature of that element. And so over time, you know, I've grown in respect for this technology. And it hasn't been out that long, but certainly in the last year. And so Klaus has done over 200 scans of various sacred sites because you don't have to be there to do it. It's a satellite scan. And so he's been working in the Philippines digging for 8.5 months, and they were quite successful as getting the support of the government and that sort of thing. And so they're really deep now, and they haven't made the final discovery. But even if they did, it's for his client to disclose it, not for him. But because of the tests they've done, what they found in the scan that says there's something here, this is what's there, and then they go and dig and find it, it's an increasing reliability and validity.
Right.
The more things that are verified that these scans have found, and they appear to be unbelievably accurate.
Fascinating. And one of the exciting things they've found down there is a labyrinth.
It's called the Labyrinth of Egypt, and it's based on Kircher, K-I-R-C-H-E-R, in 1671, made a copper engraving that actually has something in the center. And this also may be a stretch, but it's been said that this thing in the center is all at once representing a labyrinth, a brain, the two sides of the brain, and a pyramid.
Huh.
The way it's drawn. And so that's why it's called the Labyrinth of Egypt, because this copper engraving was found there.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a labyrinth, but that's been the colloquial term used to refer to this place.
I see.
And in the scan that Klaus did of it, we found two levels, distinct levels. One we call the blue level, which is 20 meters deep, and one we call the red level, which is 40 meters deep. Okay, so this is over an area of 107 acres. That's 81 football fields.
Wow.
The two levels are not like in the Valley of the Kings, for example, where there's 79 rooms in KV-55 and it goes down, down, down like snakes and ladders and everything's connected. It appears that the two levels are completely disconnected. In archaeology, older is deeper. And so that's a principle. But measuring the size of the rooms from the scan, because they actually gave the outlines of the rooms and where there was passageways, there's 63 rooms. It's 9.6 acres interior, which is a lot. So it's like 81 football fields, and these rooms are separate. So it's not like a temple where you go in through the first hypostyle hall and through to get to the Holy of Holies. It appears that they're separate chambers. But six of these rooms are bigger than Olympic-sized swimming pools.
That's huge.
And there's 1.4 kilometers of passageways that connect them on one level.
Incredible.
I know. And they found artifacts in the scan. Now, the process of getting permits to dig and whether that's going to happen and all that is a separate issue. I think that it's already something that could be there. And judging from, and I've been following Klaus's work and where they've been digging and the results, and I've got diagrams of it, it seems like these scans are very accurate.
Huh. Well, these structures sound like they may be an amazing find. And this is the type of discovery that could really turn history and our understanding of ancient Egypt and its chronology totally on its head. So that's very exciting.
Well, which is maybe why they won't allow it.
Right. That's an excellent point. And there is an excessive amount of control the government has over these digs in Egypt. Now, with all your research there, you've really had to face these kind of extreme obstacles just to get as far as you have in your investigations.
Yeah.
I know. That's a whole story in itself. But, you know, I wanted to ask you, since we're discussing obstacles, it was about Zahi Hawass and the kind of controversial control that he held over the Giza Plateau before he was booted and even charged with some heavy corruption allegations around his position as the antiquities minister, and also his coziness with the ousted criminal Mubarak administration. What is he up to now?
Well, last I heard from the new Zahi, was that he's been commissioned for restoration of the Suez Canal.
Amazing. He's still working those connections.
Now, again, not verified, but that's what I've been told. So he's got a contract to do that, but he's not involved in the antiquities anymore.
Well, I imagine that's a good thing.
But he's got what they call his kids.
Oh.
His sons. So he had a lot of junior archaeologists around him, and now they are still there.
Interesting. So part of the same mindset going on there. You know, I always found this fact very interesting, that both Zahi and Mark Lehner, who was also someone who became a leading Egyptologist, were originally sponsored by the ARE, the Edgar Cayce Foundation. So regardless of how they scorn alternative histories around new archaeological finds, they are very aware of what Cayce had to offer psychically on the subject of Egypt and Atlantis and the Hall of Records.
Yes, and I think Zahi spoke quite a few times in Virginia Beach at the ARE, and Mark Lehner is associated with the Oriental Institute in Chicago. And he had the so-called Pyramid Builders dig, and the Hall of Records Retreat Center was just adjacent to it. And so looking through my camera lens, it magnified it, and I could ride horses around there. And so, so they found a number of things. I don't know if it necessarily shows that they were pyramid builders or it came later. But yes, that's where Mark started, was being associated also with the ARE.
What I find so odd about this is that they are both the biggest proponents of the official story, and some would say official fiction, of the history of ancient Egypt, which is totally at odds with the Casey version, which dates it back to 10,500 BC. So isn't it interesting that these two leading skeptics of alternative research and the Atlantis-Egypt connection both got their start because of the Edgar Casey Foundation, and as you say, they even lecture there occasionally. So I guess bashing his theories is a strange way to say thank you. And it's also unusual that in their official biographies, this isn't really brought forward at all. I actually have a book written by Mark Lehner from 1974, and it's called The Egyptian Heritage, based on the readings of Edgar Casey, and that's the title. So there's no spinning that. And it's all about Casey's version of Egypt and Atlantis and the Sphinx and the Hall of Records. So he's very aware of this stuff. And I find it very interesting and unusual. All I can imagine is that somewhere along the line, he got lost.
Well, and there's a word I'd like to offer. Political.
Right, right.
It's political. So he was offered something or, you know, there's a story behind it.
Absolutely. But you would think that even though officially they say, well, we don't believe in Atlantis and we wouldn't believe Casey's psychic readings anyway, yet secretly they've been looking for years to find the very same thing that we're talking about here, which is the Hall of Records left there by the Atlanteans.
Yep.
That would be a reasonable conclusion to come to on the whole thing.
Right. And I think the reason that Klaus is digging in the Philippines is that there isn't so much government interference.
Right.
And it's not easy. You're right. It's not easy to get anything done. It's not easy to get film permits. It's not easy to do any of it.
Well, hypothetically speaking, what do you think we would find inside the Atlantean Hall of Records if it were discovered?
Well, first of all, I think that there's two levels. So I think that the upper level could be Atlantean material, technology, treasures, that sort of thing. But I think that the deeper level could be even far older than that. And yeah, I've speculated before what I think that could be, and my soul is deeply tied to getting this answer. And at this point, we're just speculating, but where did we come from in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And why is there so much interest in all these five cultures that I mentioned before, in Sirius, the Pleiades, Orion, Cygnus, these various star systems? And when you look at the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, for example, and many different artifacts, they didn't seem to be as, I want to say, square or nervous about connections to stars. So if you look at King Tut's, the shrine at King Tut's that was found in his tomb, there's all these, you know, the being with energy going to his head and then a star over the top and then feet walking. There's all kinds of things where you see the stars beside these figures that are going up steps, and it's archetypal. And that's one of the things that we're attempting to unpack and show what the Egyptians were thinking and how that worked. But we've departed so far in this culture from, you know, the idea of archetypal beings, star beings, channeling, having a communication with ancestors that are disincarnate. You know, we went through the Inquisition. That was a no-no. If you thought that, they'd kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So many people at the cellular level go, no, 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 we're not going there. And it disturbs the story we're supposed to tell, the story we're supposed to know. And yet, look at what's going on. I mean, you're a choice person to have looked and looked and looked and interviewed people and around corners and underneath and all, you know. And there is another story than the official story that we've been given in mainstream media. And, you know, I think there's more and more people that know that mainstream media isn't necessarily true. And I think the tragedy of our current culture is that truth is an option.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's quite a syndrome we're dealing with. The recognition, the find of the century, of something that proved conclusively that there was an Atlantis, how do you think modern culture would respond to that?
Well, I think there'd be a whole lot of people that would get hostile and say it's a lie. And I've actually had a little taste of that lately. Get right. A little bit hostile. Oh, that scan, there's nothing to the scan. I haven't heard about it, so it can't exist. But there has been a find recently. And I've studied the Amarna period over a long period of time. And it's Nefertiti and Akhenaten and how they moved to Akhetaten and started over.
Yes.
And the Amun priesthood, and they broke away. Now, if you go digging and go research Akhenaten and Nefertiti, you're going to find countless things that say Akhenaten was Moses, except they're 800 years apart.
Right.
Akhenaten was crazy, disfigured, and sick. And the Amun priesthood were the ones that were the good guys, and that they wanted to do one god, and they worshipped a disc, a solar disc, and, you know, kind of make them infantile. But to me, every time I hear something like that or read it, I have this physical reaction of just, no, that's not it. And so, you know, like, they're going to look for Nefertiti and find her. Well, they already think they found her some 8 years ago, but now they're looking again.
And, exactly. You know,
there's all that going on. But I don't think that Nefertiti stayed in Egypt. And Amarna was ransacked. The Amun priesthood lost their power. They were collecting half of people's harvests for people to get their salvation.
Yeah.
The ceremony of the weighing of the hearts, where, yeah, your heart's light, just pay us the money and we'll give you some Shakti dolls and you're good to go. Well, that's corrupt. That's not spirituality. And so they didn't like that Nefertiti and Akhenaten went back to true spirituality and creativity and beauty and, you know, empowerment of the people who lived there. And so there is a story that goes with it all. And they came to get Akhenaten, and I say they killed him.
Uh-huh.
And I say Nefertiti left. And so when they're looking for her, they found her. Oh, now they're looking for her again. I seriously, in my bones, I feel she walked out.
That is fascinating. And I know you have some information about Akhenaten and Nefertiti that everyone watching is going to find just astounding. So, Carmen, we'll wrap up here with this episode and start right in with part two. So please hang in there. And for everyone, this episode will be available for you on Thursday, April 28th. Next week, part two will be available for subscribers at darkjournalist.com. So go ahead and subscribe now. This really is the time, and that helps the show a lot. And also, you'll receive some excellent content, HD video, high-quality audio, and more. So, Carmen, thank you so much, and I'm real excited for part two.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode on the Breakthrough Atlantean-Egyptian Connection with Dr. Carmen Bolter. You can find more special reports, interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist. Let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.